This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
And many academic books also suggest when you are a startup, you want to identify the market. Don't go after your competitor's number one customers. Go after the segment within your competitor's marketplace who is forgotten, who isn't a priority, and you can snip away and take those customers. And the theory is, as you chip away at these customers who they consider to be low priority, those customers gravitate towards you because you're focused on their solution and their needs. And all that tends to happen is the customer says, okay, we don't have to defend our market share against these small customers. This little tiny startup's focused on such a small segment. What the big competitors forget is that you're chipping it away and you're going upscale, upscale, upscale until, you know, you've built a damn badass product focused around this niche that's actually quite lucrative. Then you go after the big heavyweights. Don't go after your competitors' heavyweight customers from day one. Be very careful with how you approach them, and especially for startups who want to stay under the radar, be very critical or be very stubborn with how you define your ICP, your ideal customer persona or profile. That would be my advice, and it's worked well. If you're going to go, the other idea is if you're going to go after a big customer, then in some ways you risk being a bit of a tech dev shop for the big customer, but really then build out needs for that top customer and make sure the needs you build are needs that scale across the entire marketplace you're going for. Because if a big customer has a certain problem or a certain workflow and you try to solve their problem, it might be that that product you built is only useful for that use case and that other big companies or other companies in the marketplace operate differently. So that's, you know, you can do it two ways, but if you're going to do that, then really, really be critical or rather, I say stubborn with regards to the product features you choose.
Totally. And I think what's interesting, I've always seen, and this is a total outsider view of commercial real estate. That's for any listener out there. Like that's where I come from. I wasn't in the business. So I see it a little bit differently than maybe a leasing agent or asset manager or, you know, portfolio manager does. But in my simple brain from the leasing transaction process, you know, the friction only increases with volume. And so my theory was, if you can get the smaller users who have smaller volume or fewer amounts of transactions to really, really be good with your product, then great, that's a checkbox. And then you have to make sure that exactly what you mentioned, you're building functionality, you're building a product that is scalable. And if you're doing that, then naturally it's somewhat of a stair step where it's like, oh, as we scale and as we get larger customers, that problem is being solved at a higher volume and a faster rate because we proved it out on the smaller customer, we built a scalable technology product, and so thus these larger users are able to more quickly adopt what we have built and early on in the life cycle of the business.
Carl, what are you seeing in the overall marketplace right now? The economy is returning back to normal. There's a recovery happening. What's going on when it comes to the level of transactions in the industry?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different if you look at what I would term the three major asset classes for leasing: office, industrial, retail. Industrial, for all the reasons that everyone's likely aware of at this point, is through the roof. I mean, companies are trading industrial properties like it's it's just hotcakes, which is pretty funny. And there's just tons of development. There's tons of activity on industrial all across the nation. Obviously, that has to do with the rise in e-commerce and, you know, retail sales increasing and all of those things. So
is industrial frothy right now? Do you feel like people are overpaying and chasing what they perceive as a new hot asset class and the smart money's leaving or not at all, and that you think it's a good theme for the future?
I think it's a good theme for the future. It needs to be watched in the next 18 months because even in Dallas, I was actually on an industrial panel just a week and a half ago, and there were a couple of, you know, major market leaders from a number of the largest REITs in the world. And they were mentioning that they're starting to see that little shift in frothiness where it's like certain people are, you're like, you really overpaid for that. Like that's not really in line with where our market is. And so I wouldn't say there's been this like pendulum shift towards frothiness. I still think we're at a really good, frankly, good margin in terms of what people are seeing and what they're buying. But they're starting to see a little bit of movement in that direction. So currently, no. Long term, yes, good prospects, but ultimately, people need to be wise.
If you break down industrial, do you consider self-storage to be part of that, or do you consider that a separate asset class? And you're really referring to the warehouse model. How would you describe industrial?
Yeah, I describe industrial a little bit more simply as like the warehousing, the cold storage, the distribution type stuff, and self-storage is more in its own asset class from my perspective.
So are you seeing demand for industrial in certain hotspots around the country, or is industrial working anywhere? Do you feel like there's a land grab right now where you need industrial warehouses everywhere because Amazon's taken over the world and every online retailer wants to figure out the supply chain? Or do you feel like there's certain core markets where it's really good and other core markets where it's a bad bet?
We've seen it pretty much all over. I mean, anywhere from New Jersey, we've seen it in Boston, we've seen it in Atlanta, we've seen it in LA, we've seen it in Phoenix, we've seen it in Chicago. Obviously, we've seen it in Dallas. Amazingly, the only market that I really haven't seen it be actually that great is Houston. Houston hasn't been a huge industrial winner the past 24 months, which is ironic because even 5-6 years ago, Houston was a massive industrial winner. And that was before industrial was actually, as hot, obviously, or as recognizable as it is today. But being in Dallas, we're just a little bit spoiled. We have like a totally different view on things than other places around the country for a lot of different reasons. Industrial has been pretty hot just about all over. And where we've seen, obviously the institutional money has gone in to the major metropolitan areas, but it's even gone into the secondary markets. I look at somewhere like a Charlotte or a Nashville. Those markets have also grown. Orlando, from an industrial perspective, has grown. There's just, the secondary markets that I wouldn't say typically qualify as your main industrial places have still gained a lot of traction.
What's driving the demand for industrial and secondary markets? Is it the same thing that drives the demand in primary markets, or is it more nuanced?
I would say it's a little bit more nuanced. Like what we've seen in Nashville is a lot of industrial development right around the airport. I mean, obviously the airport's the huge driver because of ability to get goods in and out, but it's a little bit cheaper. I mean, if you can't find something around Hartsfield in Atlanta, well, let's go look for something in Nashville. I mean, you're not that far away, and not to way oversimplify industrial, but in Nashville, you've also got Amazon's second or third headquarters is now moving there at some point. And so there's reasons these things are happening, but I would say the land is a little bit cheaper. It's a little bit easier to get in the metropolitan areas. I mean, and I'll just give you the Dallas example. In the major markets, you're having to go further and further and further out from your main industrial development hubs than you were even 12 months ago. And so, that was a big discussion last week on the industrial panel I was on is, they're moving now, 30 minutes away from major metropolitan airports, or 45 minutes away instead of 15, 20 minutes away in terms of kind of the timing. So they're just having to develop in different places. And Nashville, you're not having to do that. Maybe Orlando, you're not having to do that, et cetera.
Any major innovations or disruptions you're seeing in the industrial space? Robotics, drones, better supply chain logistics and tracking, anything you think is going to really change the game for people that are in the industrial asset class when it comes to technology?
Yes. I mean, there's so much opportunity. And frankly, COVID has created a whole set of new opportunities for people to go launch startups. So anybody listening, quick plug, go launch a startup that solves a problem that you recognized in COVID, because it's a great opportunity to go do that. And from what we've seen, and I'll just kind of brag on one of the owners in the space that we've dealt with a number of times, but Prologis is so technologically advanced on how they deal and manage with their operation. And some of what I've always been a little bit intrigued by is industrial is by nature an efficient business. It has to be. That it's at its core. You're taking, basically good from one place to another and delivering it to a person. So industrial tenants, in my view, need great technology to be as efficient as humanly possible. And there are certain companies like Prologis that are frankly, providing.
Carl, does that mean that the industrial tenants are most forward-looking and are more receptive to technology then?
Yes.
Or are they slow to adopt?
No, I would say the group, I mean, obviously, Amazon's the best test case in the world on this. Amazon took technology at their core, put it into their, you know, their main business on distribution, and you can see what they've done.
And are you seeing, when it comes to industrial, are you seeing more ground-up development? Are you seeing repurposing of big box retail and, you know, other facilities and upgrading them, converting them? Or are you seeing just more trading going on where industrial players are realizing great returns by selling it to, you know, new investors? What's driving the leasing activity?
Lots of ground-up development. I'll never forget, I had a call last April, so April 2020, the height of the lockdown. And a friend of mine, they've got a lot of industrial around the country, and he said, we're building 20 more million feet. I was like, what? You're building? And he was like, yeah, we're building. We're going to ground up build 20 more million feet. And I was thinking, gosh, if you're doing that, there's 100 or 500 more people just like you that are probably thinking along the same line. So lots of ground
just
development.
Just to let you know, Bluefield's doing the same. We're our partner. We're building 10 million square feet in Utah. It's just, we can't get enough of industrial.
Correct. Which is, I mean, it's great. It's great for the market. I think what's really interesting is to see how the, and you mentioned it kind of in your options there, the repurposing of retail is going to be fascinating to me. I know there was a repurpose of a mall in Detroit that actually went into light industrial, kind of flex industrial distribution space. I'm intrigued to see that grow. I think we're at the really early innings of that kind of repurposing. That's going to be on a market by market basis, but I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think you have a lot, you're going to end up with a lot of space that needs to be utilized and should be utilized. You shouldn't just have empty buildings sitting out there, obviously. They should be utilized. And if you've got tenants that are willing to take the risk and occupy those assets and repurpose them for their needs, then I think there's no reason that shouldn't happen.
So what's going on with retail?
Oh, retail. Retail is just a totally different beast. Obviously, with COVID, you haven't had people out doing, you know, the typical shopping or being in stores. As COVID eases and restrictions not go away, but are become a little bit less restrictive, people should be out and about more. But I don't know how quickly it's going to return to whatever this normal is. I take a look at office and retail in a little bit of the same bucket, where we've seen office activity rise. We've also seen retail activity. And also, I'm in Dallas, so like, take my Dallas kind of facts and figures a little bit grain of salt. It's not not obviously comprehensive of the whole market. But in Dallas, office and retail have actually still been pretty popular. There's still been decent demand. Things are not, you know, totally flatlined, totally dead. But anytime you get retail and small business where certain small businesses lose out because of COVID, which is so sad, that in a certain sense creates opportunity for new small business to come in and new people to take risk. It really depends on, in my view, the overall market and the risk appetite, and is the market creating an environment for those newer retailers to take that risk and kind of jump in to that area.